You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Ah, spring. Nothing like the world progressing towards summer to inspire your own progress. That's what life's all about, in your career, relationships, and your finances. Let's talk about that last one. With the Chime Secured Credit Builder Visa Credit Card, it's easy to start building credit with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments with no annual fees or interest. So your weekly grocery run can feel even more productive, and that morning coffee can taste like a little victory. And if your credit scores grow, so could your opportunities to get lower rates on loans, like for a new ride or finally having a home to call your own. Sounds like progress, right? With Chime's secure credit card, you can start improving your credit scores right away. Get started today at chime.com/build. That's chime.com/build. Chime feels like progress. The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A., members FDIC. Out-of-network ATM withdrawal and OTC advance fees may apply. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. It's almost become a tired platitude to say that the U.S. political system is broken. Americans said it after the 2000 presidential election, and they said it after the 2016 election. They said it after the stalled appointment of Merrick Garland, and they said it after the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh. Many said it after the Mueller investigation and after the impeachment acquittal of Donald Trump. But what if the American political system isn't broken? What if it's working exactly as designed? According to journalist and Vox co-founder Ezra Klein, quote, "The American political system, which includes everyone from voters to journalists to the president, is full of rational actors making rational decisions given the incentives they face." He says, "We are a collection of functional parts whose efforts combine into a dysfunctional whole." And now in his new book, titled Why We're Polarized, Ezra Klein reveals how that system is polarizing us and how we are polarizing it with disastrous results. Today, Ezra joins me on the podcast to explain how the Founding Fathers planned for many things, but they didn't design a system of government intended to function effectively in times of hyperpartisanship. He points out that politics came into being to represent deep social cleavages, but now politics is the cleavage. And our political affiliation has gone from being one of many identities Americans hold to becoming what he calls a mega-identity that's consuming our lives, making us angrier, and destroying friendships and families. We discuss how politicians and voters got stuck in a feedback loop of negative partisanship, and how polarization has led many of our leaders in Washington to conclude that bipartisanship is actually irrational. Of course, all of this is egged on by political media, and Ezra suggests that our access to an overwhelming deluge of political news on cable, talk radio, and social media is actually making us less informed. Plus, we get into how demographic threat is fueling political anger, how the rise of extremism correlates with a decline in the influence of parties, and Ezra offers a few recipes for how to reunite the country and make America more democratic. Coming up with Ezra Klein in just a moment. Ezra Klein is the editor-at-large and co-founder of Vox, the award-winning explanatory news organization. Launched in 2014, Vox reaches more than 50 million people across its platforms each month. Klein is also the host of the podcast The Ezra Klein Show, co-host of the Weeds podcast, and an executive producer on Vox's Netflix show Explained. Previously, Klein was a columnist and editor at The Washington Post, a policy analyst at MSNBC, and a contributor to Bloomberg. Now he's out with a new book that seeks to explain the mystery of our times, Why We're Polarized. Ezra Klein, welcome.
Happy to be here.
Well, that is the big question, isn't it? And you actually open this book by first addressing a different question in looking at the 2016 presidential election and in a little bit of a dig at Hillary Clinton's book. You say that the question we need to ask isn't what happened, but what didn't happen. What do you mean by that?
So I talk a bit about Clinton's book at the beginning of mine, and in this respect, which is that what Clinton's book is doing, and it is an interesting book, it's worth reading if you haven't, is trying to explain how Donald Trump cleared that roughly, let's call it 75,000 vote margin in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan. And one of the problems with the way the 2016 election went is that the margin was so close and also so unusual. He obviously lost a popular vote while winning the Electoral College, and it was such a razor-thin margin that almost anything can explain that. But I think the question you need to ask about 2016 isn't how Donald Trump was able to get those 75,000 votes, but how is he ever close enough to win? Mm-hmm. Or how was it not the case that he was so far ahead there was no chance of him losing? I mean, he was a very unusual candidate. He had not traditionally been a Republican. He had all kinds of heterodoxies from party orthodoxy. He came in and he attacked previously Republican standard bearers like George W. Bush and John McCain. He had talked about how much he loved Planned Parenthood. He was sort of decadent and loose in his personal habits. He was very, let's call it, eccentric in the way he campaigned. He had these like all caps locks tweets and said that potentially Ted Cruz's father was involved in the assassination of JFK. He was a weird guy. Yeah. And so you might have expected that either he would lose by 20 points or maybe he would win by 20 points. And what I show in that first chapter is that what's remarkable about Donald Trump's performance in 2016 is if you just look at the numbers, it looks like 2012 and it looks like 2008. And if you just go back over the past four, let's call it elections, and I just show you exit poll numbers for different races, religions, genders, ideologies, parties, etc., you would not be able to pick 2016 out of a lineup. Huh. And so when I say the question really is what didn't happen, what I'm saying there is the question is, how did somebody unusual as Donald Trump crash into American politics? Mm-hmm. And instead of it really reshaping American politics somehow, the election nevertheless fell into the almost exact same grooves with a couple changes on the margins from Mitt Romney, from John McCain, from George W. Bush. What can explain a political structure so stable that even Donald Trump can't truly disrupt it?
Interesting. So this whole idea that the Trump election in 2016 was an anomaly is a bit of a myth then.
Trump himself is certainly an anomaly. He is a very unusual candidate. But in terms of how the vote goes down, it's not an anomaly at all. Basically, what happens is Donald Trump puts together Mitt Romney's coalition and trades out some college-educated whites for some working-class whites. Like that's basically how it goes. And it turns out that the working-class whites, right, the non-college whites, are concentrated in a couple very electorally important states. And so that is enough to get him over the finish line. But again, it's just not a very big change. You would not look at it and say that what happened is a Republican coalition reshaped itself around Donald Trump. It's not that huge numbers of never-Trumpers joined the Democrats, huge numbers of Democratic voters joined Trump. I mean, there has been a lot of attention to these Obama to Trump voters. But in truth, there's not many more of them than there were Romney to Clinton voters. I mean, there's a certain amount of change over any election, but it doesn't look like there's anything so dramatic that happened there.
And you say something very interesting in Why We're Polarized, that politics came into being to represent deep social cleavages, but now politics has become that cleavage. It sounds to me like you're saying that we're being divided by a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. Is that what's happening?
There are two things that have to be held in tension here. One of the stories of my book is about how the political coalitions, let's call them the red and blue coalitions, though you could call them the Republican and Democratic coalitions, have become more different than each other in both ideological and demographic terms. And so as that has happened, as they really have become more different in their vision of the country, in who they either are or are believed to be working on behalf of, the stakes of politics have both perceptually and in many cases in truth become much higher for people. So an example I use in the book is that if you look at the 1976 Republican Party convention platform, it has a plank on abortion where it says, in our party, there are people who believe abortion should be available on demand and there are people who believe it should be illegal in all circumstances, and we respect that difference of opinion. That isn't how it reads today. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if you look at the 96 Democratic convention, you look at immigration, Bill Clinton's convention platform sounds like Donald Trump sounds today. So what has happened is the parties have become much more different. So they're fighting, what they are fighting over is often much clearer. And as such, it's not sounding very signifying nothing. That said, there is another level and layer of politics, which is not competition over well-articulated policy goals, which is not difference in vision for how to run the country. This layer is identity. This layer is group status competition. And here, the question of who wins and who loses is often really not about policy at all. People will change their policy positions to fit what their party needs them to believe. Their party will change its policy positions to fit what it needs to do for power. And people will run behind that, and they will get very, very, very angry at the other side, not because of a genuine difference in governance philosophy, but because we've become very attached to our groups. We trust our group to advocate on our behalf. And as such, when our group is losing, we take that very personally. We feel that very deeply. We become very nervous. We become very upset. I show some evidence in the book from Liliana Mason, a political scientist at the University of Maryland. And she ran a clever experiment. There's this huge national poll that follows every election or goes alongside every election called the American National Election Survey. And one of the things you can do with that is you can look at Republicans whose policy positions should make them Democrats and Democrats whose policy positions should make them Republicans. And then you can also look at people who their identity groups normally would put them in the other party. So let's say a Democrat who's an older man who lives in the South and is an evangelical Christian. Right. Normally, somebody who fits that demographic profile would be a Republican, but this guy's a Democrat. And what she shows is that a Democrat who agrees with Republicans on policy or vice versa, that does less to mitigate hostility and fear of the other party than having your group affiliations fit in the other party. So the person whom people like them are in the other party, they'll be less afraid of the other party winning than even a person who actually agrees with the other party on the merits, which goes to what you're saying there, which is so much as the stakes of politics are very real, oftentimes what is being activated are not the policy stakes of politics, but the psychological attachment to our group and fear of the outgroup.
Yeah, and politics is just one of many identities that we have. There's an identity as a father or a mother, a spouse, pet owner, a vegan, a Christian, little league coach, Rotary, environmentalist, a million different things. But you say that politics has now become a mega identity that dwarfs so much else. How did that come to be? Was there something lacking in us that politics filled? Why are we choosing to find our tribe in something that is so ugly and ultimately unfulfilling on a personal level?
It's a great question. I'm not sure I can answer even that one. But I can say how politics became these sort of mega identities.
Okay.
And this is a story that goes through the 20th century quite a bit. American politics in the 20th century was really weird. I've said at a bunch of the events for this book that the question on some level isn't why we're polarized, but why was there a period in American politics when we weren't? Why in mid-century American politics did we not split by party in the way we do now? And it's important that I'm pretty clear on what I'm saying here, because people use the term polarized as just a synonym for bad. Polarized is bad, it's bitter, divisive, angry. That is not what it means. What it means in this case is we're polarized by party. We are clustering around two poles, be those poles our party affiliation, our ideologies, whatever it might be. So in mid-century American politics, you have tremendous stakes. You have very deep, bitter divisions. I mean, you're looking in that period at the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the indigenous rights movement, the anti-war movement. There are political assassinations, urban riots, protesters being killed at Kent State. The stakes of politics are very high, and America is very fractured. But the parties are very internally mixed. And so you have, say, anti-Vietnam War sentiment is actually equally distributed across the two parties. The Civil Rights Act itself passes in a perfectly bipartisan way. It's led in the Senate by the Republican minority leader. And it, in the end, it has a higher proportion of congressional Republicans voting for it than congressional Democrats. And then it's signed by a Democratic president, Lyndon Johnson. And so we had very deep divisions, but they weren't sorted by party. That had a lot to do with civil rights itself and race itself. We were functionally a four-party system, with the Democratic Party having Democrats as we think about them today, and then this very conservative Southern Dixiecrat wing that was extremely powerful in the party. It led almost all the important committees in Congress. It held a veto at the convention. But it was very conservative. And what it was functionally doing was entering into a power sharing agreement with the National Democratic Party in order to continue enforcing white supremacy in the South. Then the Republican Party had, again, Republicans, if you think of them today, the conservative side of the ideological spectrum. But then Northern liberals, quite a few of them, people like George Romney or John Lindsay or Scranton, who were very liberal. So this was a period when Strom Thurmond was a Democrat, and he was the second most conservative member of the Senate. So as long as that was true, the parties were so strange and internally mixed that they didn't represent our identities very clearly. You might be a Democrat, but you voted for Republicans a lot. Ticket splitting votes were very, very common. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't a big part of identity. After the Civil Rights Act, this begins to change. The Southern Dixiecrats slowly become Republicans. The Northern liberal Republicans become Democrats. And that sets up this opening for the parties to begin to sort not just by ideology. So now the Democratic Party becomes a liberal party, the Republican Party becomes the conservative party, but really by everything else. We sort by race. We were not very well sorted by race across the two parties, but now the Democratic Party is 50% non-white, roughly. The Republican Party is 90% white. We sort by religion. That had not been a big sorting dynamic before. Now the single largest religious group in the Democratic Party are the religiously unaffiliated. The Republican Party is overwhelmingly Christian. We sort by culture, by psychology, by a bunch of different things, by geography. It did not used to tell you much about your politics or about a person's politics if they lived in a city or a rural area. Today, there is no density in America that votes Republicans, that votes Republican, and rural areas are overwhelmingly Republican. And so when that happens, what is going on is that a lot of our identities are stacking on top of each other. So now politics, it's not just your ideology, but it's also all these other things. It's what kind of person you are. It's where you live. It's whether or not you're an atheist. It's whether or not you live in a city. And it's how you feel other people feel about you. If you watch much politics or you watch political ads, and I know you're a student of those, you can see this come out. I mean, there's a very famous ad that was used by the Club for Growth, a conservative anti-tax group against Howard Dean, back in 2004. And it's like these two older white people standing outside. I think it's like some kind of general store, basically. And, you know, the off-camera interviewer says, "What do you think of Howard Dean?" And they say, and I'm doing this a little bit from memory, but, "Oh, he should take his latte-sipping, sushi-eating, freak show, Hollywood-loving, blah, 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 blah." And none of that was ideological. It was just like these were identities, cultural signifiers mm-hmm. that were associated with liberals. And the idea was if you're, you know, a conservative heartland American, you're not going to like them. Mm-hmm. So this process of identity stacking has made it so our political identities encompass and absorb conflicts from a lot of other very important identities, right? Like heartlanders versus coastal elites, that kind of thing. And that makes those political identities more important because it activates them every time one of those other very significant identities is threatened or called into a fight.
Yeah. I mean, if you had asked me 20 or 30 years ago to describe a Democrat or a Republican, I would probably have a tough time conjuring up an image of a Republican or Democratic voter. But now we have these very easy stereotypes of each other.
It's an exciting time to be alive. And it's not just you. There's a data I show in the book that today, low information voters are more certain of the differences between the two political parties than high information voters were in the 70s. And that's just an amazing statistic. And the thing I say about that is that there's a very easy reason for it. It isn't that low information voters today have more information. They don't. It's that the differences between the parties are clearer. Back then, I forget, I wish I had this number in front of me. I think it's something like when Ford was running against Carter, about 50% of voters could not tell you if the Republican Party was the more conservative party.
Wow.
About 50%. So, and part of the reason is it wasn't clear that it was. And that's something that I cannot stress enough, that polarization, what we think of as polarization, the set of downstream effects we're seeing here, they are in many ways a rational response to the parties becoming more different. They're what you would expect us to do as the choice becomes clearer, as the other party becomes more threatening to us. I write this in the book and I show it at some length, but the difference between the political philosophies represented by George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton in 1992 is just a lot less clear than the difference between the political philosophies and demographic coalitions represented by Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in 2016. Making a choice between Clinton and Bush in 92 and making a choice was much harder and created much more space for moving back and forth than a choice between Clinton and Trump in 2016, where on some level, if you don't know what side of that debate you're on, it's hard even to know how you don't know what side of that debate they're on because they're so different on everything.
And while we're on the subject of the history of polarization, since it's President's Day, I'd like to go back to the very beginning. I mean, we all know that George Washington sort of futilely warned against political parties in his farewell address. When the founding fathers were writing the Constitution, do you think that they formed a system of government that was designed to function well in a hyper-partisan environment? Did they plan for the kind of political divides that we see today?
No, not at all. And I mean, this is the original sin of our Constitution, and it's creating huge distortions and instabilities today. There's a lot to be said here. I will say on that George Washington farewell address that one thing historians will tell you about it, and I just love this. It is a beautiful address, and if you read it, it is prophetic in many ways. But it's uniquely American in that it is very much a warning against political parties on behalf of a political party. I mean, at that point, Washington's administration is split functionally into the Jeffersonian wing and the Hamiltonian wing, the Federalists and the Jeffersonian Republicans. People may have heard of this. They later made a musical about it. And the thing that comes out of that is Washington is very much on the side of the Federalists. And he gives this speech that is not about that there shouldn't be political parties. It's that really you should agree with the one that he represents and the other one is bad and it's going to create factionalism. Everybody hates parties in American life. We always have. But what we mean by that is we hate the other party. What we mean by that is people should agree with us or be willing to compromise with us. And so it creates this very deep difficulty because we are alienated and always have been. And it runs right through the Constitution itself from arguably the central organizing institution of not just American politics, but democratic, small-d democratic politics in basically every country that we know of. Parties are a natural part of this. So the American Constitution, what it does is it creates a system designed to balance really two things. One is geography. Almost the entire system from the state equal representation in the Senate to the way we do House districts, even in a way up to the Electoral College, is built to represent place, not just people. You don't win in American politics by getting the most people. You win by getting the most places. And that's why Republicans control the Senate despite winning fewer votes in those elections, control the White House despite winning fewer votes in that election. So we're not in any way a small-d democracy in terms of people, even today. And there's also built to balance this question of mob rule versus small-d democratic rule, which, of course, the demos then was a lot smaller in terms of who could vote and who is imagined to ever be able to vote than it is now. But nevertheless, there was a lot of concern on the part of a lot of the founding fathers that you would have these mobs electing demagogues, and they built things like the Electoral College to stop it. It's a real historical irony that the Electoral College has become a way that somebody like Donald Trump became president as opposed to the institution that stopped him from becoming president. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, at that time, you're balancing the slave owning and the states that did not buy into slavery in the same way. So all of that then plays forward into American politics in this modern era where the fundamental political institutions we're balancing are not small states versus big states or mob rule versus small D democratic rule or elite rule, but parties. We are red and blue. And if you don't believe me, imagine tomorrow that in the Senate there comes a vote on whether or not Puerto Rico and D.C. should become states. Do you think that the way that vote would go is that every small state would vote for it because D.C. and Puerto Rico are small states and that'll mean the small states have a bigger coalition to balance against the large states? Or would Wyoming vote with Texas against it and Vermont would vote with New York for it because the belief is D.C. and Puerto Rico are going to send Democrats to the Senate?
Right.
And of course, that question answers itself, but it shows how much we are working off of a political system built to balance something different than what we are balancing now. And that's causing all sorts of weirdness and distortion in our politics.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. Wave is a free, easy-to-use financial software that helps freelancers, consultants, and small business owners make, move, and manage their money, bringing them closer to financial success through accounting, invoicing, payments, and payroll. Just like Chris. Chris started his own business 3 years ago and has been using Wave ever since. He was never confident about the financial aspects of running his own business, but since discovering Wave,
he was relieved to find a service that made invoicing and payments so straightforward. Wave's free accounting, receipt management, and invoicing tools give your business the professionalism it deserves. Have employees? Wave can pay them directly and automate your payroll tax filings. Payroll helps business owners like Sean. Sean felt like he was dealing with taxes and payroll every day, and making sure everyone got paid took away the enjoyment of running his business. Having automatic deductions with payroll let him get back to what he enjoys doing most. I only recently started using Wave for my own accounting and invoicing needs. I was sick of the hassle of invoicing, just chasing down clients for payment and juggling numbers. It was such a headache, and honestly, who needs it? I just wanted to be able to focus on my business and producing my podcast. That's why I really took to Wave's easy-to-use accounting software. It's simple, it's intuitive, and it saves me time. In fact, now I'm using Wave for my payroll as well. The bottom line is, Wave simplifies my life. You can't put a price on that. But you know what? Wave's free, so that's even better. It's time to ditch the Excel spreadsheets, shoeboxes full of receipts, and lost invoices, and start growing your business. Set up your business for financial success by signing up for your free account today at waveapps.com/kick. That's waveapps.com/kick.
I know that I've talked before with Trent Lott and Tom Daschle, actually in the same room together, who were leaders of their own parties in the Senate and, of course, had serious policy differences, but they said that they were able to see each other as equals and recognize that they were both serving for the right reasons and wanted to do right by the country. That's the kind of civility that governed the Senate for most of the 20th century. Does that exist anymore? Indeed, I think that you say that bipartisanship has become irrational in this environment. How so?
Yeah, so there's a lot there. So one reason that mid-20th century Senate was so much more civil and there was so much more comity was actually something pretty scary. The parties were deeply mixed in part because of segregation and race. Mm-hmm. So you had, again, this conservative wing in the Democratic Party. You had this liberal wing in the Republican Party. And that meant that a lot of the fundamental disagreements in American politics did not happen between the two parties. They happened inside of them. And when a disagreement happens inside of a party, the tendency to try to solve it either through suppression, don't talk about that disagreement, or compromise. So let's figure out a way forward together. If it happens between the two parties, the incentive is towards escalation and fighting. And so as the disagreements have sorted themselves into the two parties as opposed to inside of them, there is a move towards deep escalation between the two parties. So on the one hand, that has made American politics cease to function in a effective governance mode. And the reason it's made it cease to function is that the American political system is distinct and unusual in requiring a huge amount of consensus to get anything done. The House, the Senate, the presidency, they can all basically be represented by different political coalitions at the same time. You have a lot of veto points through the committee structure. You have the filibuster in the Senate. You have the Supreme Court with judicial review. So it's very hard, even in the best of circumstances, to get enough consensus to get anything done. When the condition becomes such that it is actually crazy for one of the parties to offer bipartisanship, then just like governance grinds to a halt. But I do want to be clear, because I think we can sometimes have a false nostalgia for 20th century politics, which is when that was happening, not Daschle and Lott, who were sort of the tail end of that era, but before that, you know, Joe Biden talking about his great compromises with segregationist senators. When that period is happening, what is happening is that a lot of that comity, a lot of that bipartisan civility is coming because there is a suppression of the central issues in American life, like race. I mean, for the first half of the 20th century, the only time the filibuster is really used in general is to block anti-lynching or Civil Rights Act laws. And similarly, Southern Dixiecrats hold the House Rules Committee. They're able to bottle up all kinds of civil rights legislation in the House. So there, we can look at that like American politics is working, and it was working quite well for some people, but it wasn't working well for everybody. The problem is this isn't working either. This is not like, on the one hand, we are able to fight about the things that maybe we need to disagree about, but we're not able to resolve the disputes now. Instead of, if the problem of the 20th century was suppression, suppression of conflict. The problem of the 21st century in our politics is endless conflict because no party ever has enough power to just get elected, govern against its agenda, and then the American people can decide if they like that or not. Instead, parties get elected, they fail to pass their agenda, and even if they do pass it, like Obama was able to do quite a bit, it gets shaved down and compromised down, so it feels like failure anyway. And then both sides disagree with each other and blame shift over who's to blame for the American people's problems not getting solved.
And I'll tell you, Ezra, when I consider political polarization, I sort of run into a chicken and egg situation. Are the voters pushing politicians toward more extremism, or is it the politicians who are whipping up the public and causing them to become more polarized? Or maybe is it even a little bit of both?
It's a little bit of both, but it's important that we're clear on what we mean when we say the voters. So this is one of the big puzzles of polarization. And I talk really the second half of the book is all about what I call polarization feedback loops. So the ways in which as the public, but here I mean a particular segment of the public, and we'll talk about that in a sec. As the most politically engaged members of the public become more polarized, political institutions, be they the media, which I'm in and I talk about quite a bit, or campaigns or governance strategies, they become more polarized in turn to appeal to that audience or to respond to that audience. Those more polarized strategies further polarize that audience, which further polarizes the institutions, which further polarize the audience, and so on and so forth. But it is important to say here, political scientists will argue until the sun goes down over whether or not the mass public, like your average American, has become more polarized, certainly in terms of their issue positions, right? Do they have more extreme views or even more sordid views on what we should do about healthcare, the economy, China, et cetera? And there's evidence a little bit on both sides of that, but I actually don't think it hugely matters. What is undoubtedly true is that the most politically engaged people have become much more polarized, and they have also become much more powerful. So we've moved towards party primaries. I mean, if you go back 50 or 60 years, the primary is decided at a convention, not by the actual primary system. And so somebody like Donald Trump is impossible because he would have never gotten he would never won a convention delegate process. He had to win it through primaries. So you have the people who vote in primaries who are a minority of the minority, right? It's one party and only the most active part of that party. And then in addition, you have the people who are now funding campaigns, right? The campaigns are much more reliant and much more able to be reliant on small donor donations. Small donor donations are very polarized. Most people do not give their money to politicians for nothing in return. The people who do are the people who have a very strong opinion on what should happen, on who should be the candidate, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's just this way in which what's happening is that political elites and the very politically engaged have become much more polarized, much more sordid, much more upset at the other side. And they then structure the political choices the rest of the public has to make. So an example I give of this, which I think relates to media and I think is interesting, comes with impeachment, which I've covered quite closely. I had a podcast on impeachment when that was going on.
Right.
So that is something where you have a very, very intense right-wing media ecosystem. It begins burbling up a set of conspiracy theories about Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and Burisma. Donald Trump absorbs in from that ecosystem. He's a very close watcher of Fox News. He, you know, reads things on Breitbart, that kind of thing. And then he believes it enough, even though most people didn't know anything about any of these conspiracy theories, Donald Trump knew enough about them, talking with Rudy Giuliani and others, that he actually begins to put the weight of his administration behind, to be nice about it, investigating them. Mm-hmm. When he does that, he breaches a line in American politics. It then leads to impeachment, which is itself an incredibly polarizing thing. And so now the country, most of whom never watches Fox News, much less reads Breitbart, has to respond to an entire political explosion that came from conspiracy theories that started in those ecosystems. But if you're just like a mom who's got three kids and vaguely pays attention to politics in Missouri, you now have to come up with an opinion on the Democrats are trying to actually remove Donald Trump from office versus Donald Trump was trying to investigate Joe Biden. And like, where do I fall on that? Huh. So it is not obvious to me that the American public in a mass way has become what we think of as much more polarized. They've always, to some degree, been polarized, to some degree, been unsorted. People have strong opinions, but they don't always line up with each other. The number of people who are really, really liberal all the way down the line or really conservative all the way down the line is quite small, even within parties. What is clearly true is the elites have become more polarized. They are acting in more polarized ways. They're always on Twitter having these very polarizing fights. And then they make decisions. They fund candidates. They create choices. They act in ways on legislation that creates a more polarized political system with much bigger, sharper choices. And that forces the rest of the public to act and engage in a more polarized way.
And in talking about the proliferation of conservative media over the past few years, I wonder, when conservatives decided to create some type of alternative to the mainstream media, why didn't the right build institutions similar in ethos and practices to the ones that they thought to replace, just staffed with more conservatives? Why are there more Breitbarts than Wall Street Journals out there?
Yeah, this is something I talk about in the book, and I think this is a really important question that I do not feel I fully have an answer to, but let me tell you my suspicion on it. So I show quite a bit of evidence in the book that the left-wing media ecosystem, so people who are on the left, they trust a pretty wide variety of outlets ranging from outrightly leftist or liberal all the way to very mainstream. Mm-hmm. So if you talk to Hillary Clinton voters or Democratic voters, their single most trusted news source is not MSNBC. It is CNN, and they use CNN the most, et cetera. And then on the right, they trust only a very small number of news sources and overwhelmingly conservative ones. The Wall Street Journal is one, but they trust Breitbart and overwhelmingly cluster around Fox News. So Fox News has more than twice as much trust and more than twice as much influence in terms of how many people watch it and how often they consult it as any other news source on the right. So what's happening there is that the right-wing news sources have a very hostile relationship to the mainstream media, like the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, whereas the left-wing or more liberal news sources, they have this kind of mixed-in relationship with the mainstream media. People go back and forth from those institutions. Now, if you're conservative listening to this, you will hear this and say, yeah, that's exactly the point. Those are liberal sources, even the New York Times, even CNN. There is something to that. I'm not here to tell you that's completely untrue. I've worked in those newsrooms. I worked at the Washington Post for a long time. There's no doubt in my mind that most reporters at these organizations are liberal in their personal politics. That is not really to say the organizations end up being that liberal. On some issues, I would say, particularly cultural issues, they do. But in terms of economics, in terms of foreign policy, they really don't. The kind of dominant ideology at a New York Times or a CNN is sort of like Morning Joe. It's not The Nation. But the problem on the right is that, as you say, they very much could have taken that insight and that frustration that the mainstream media felt hostile to them and then built organizations that were similar in quality and editorial process to the ones that they felt rejected by, but were simply more conservative, existed in more conservative places, and just came at the world from a different foundation and value set. And instead, what you got, you know, is somebody like Tucker Carlson promising to do that and then creating the Daily Caller, which very much does not reflect those values and that ethos. Fox News says it is fair and balanced, but I mean, look at its primetime lineup. It's very much anything but. I suspect that the reason that happened, I think there are probably a lot of them, but one is simply that the mainstream media, it's actually not that liberal. And so in order to differentiate the product enough to get an audience, they had to fight the mainstream media, right? Like enough people were getting well served enough by the mainstream media. The audience around to pick up was the audience that felt very alienated. And what they wanted was something that told them they were right in that. And so a media ecosystem that came out and said, you know what, the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times are actually right about this one. It wasn't going to survive very long. And organizations that have tried to do that in general have not. There have been a large number of failed efforts to create better media on the right. And meanwhile, something like Breitbart succeeding to the degree it has or Fox News succeeding in the way it has, it speaks to what the market really is there. So in this way, I have a somewhat, let's call it a right-wing theory of right-wing media, which is that there were a lot of efforts to see what the market actually wanted. And what the market actually wanted was this. It is capitalism working well, even if it is not politics working well. And by the way, I want to say this is not to say that more left-wing media, Vox is a more liberal institution, is perfect. We all make our mistakes. But it is to say that having a very wide variety of organizations that you listen to, and this is, I think, very important, organizations that have very different business models, ABC News, CNN, NBC News, et cetera, they do not want to be seen as liberal. That is not their business model. In fact, they want to cover liberals in a way that proves that they're not liberal. And that's why, like, the New York Times covered the Hillary Clinton email stuff day in and day out and did her incredible damage as a candidate. You don't see anything like that in the way Fox News covers Donald Trump. Nothing like that. Mm-hmm. So whether or not a lot of people are liberal on a lot of the liberal mainstream institutions, there's a set of journalistic ethoses, guild rules, industry pressure, and then on top of all that, a business model that is pushing in a different direction. And that different direction creates a diversity in the content and the product that helps, I would say, discipline some of the flights of fancy and the more ridiculous things that liberals sometimes want to do. Whereas on the right, I think that those same impulses get indulged and even escalated.
But speaking more broadly about the media, you actually say that the overwhelming access to news and information has actually made us less informed. In fact, to put it another way, you say politics is making smart people stupid. The smarter a person is, the dumber politics can make them. Does that mean I should read less news, Ezra?
I actually think you probably should read less national political news, and I talk about that at the end of the book, and I know that's a bit of an admission against interest, but let me break down a couple things in that. So when I talk about politics making smart people stupid, what I'm referring to there, I have a section that is about political psychology and the way we absorb information when our political identities are implicated. And one of the things you see there is that smarter people will engage in more partisan self-deception, which is to say that people who are absorbing more information, what they're doing is not going out there in a neutral search for truth. They're out there finding information that backs up what they want to believe. They're in echo chambers in some cases, but even when they're not, they're reading things they agree with and believing it, and reading things they don't agree with and rejecting it, and finding ways to tell a coherent story about why they and their group are right about the world. So you'll see, and I show studies about this, when you take people who know a lot about politics, they're very good at looking at a question and finding the answer they need to find. When you take people who don't know that much about politics, they often have more accurate perceptions of certain things. Like, for instance, did the economy improve or not improve under Bill Clinton? They just may do or don't like Bill Clinton. It's the people with a ton of information who have an esoteric argument that they read in the National Review for why the good economy was actually a bad economy if you really understood it, that kind of thing. So partisanship and particularly high levels of partisanship create a filter through which we understand and absorb information. And that very much can take very smart people. And it doesn't exactly, I'm being a little glib when I say it makes them stupid. What it does is it uses their intelligence in the service of their political opinions, not in the service of abstract truth seeking, which, you know, I mean, think about people, you know, think about yourself. This is pretty obvious stuff. Mm-hmm. I do think most people end up primarily nowadays being too attached to political news, which is very manipulative, which is very turned up. I talk a lot about how the business models of the new system have changed, how much the attentional competition has changed the way we write, the way we act, how much identity we sort of lace into our things, how our work is distributed. I mean, even if you're an organization and you're doing a lot of like very calm, very judicious work, if what is happening is a lot of your traffic is coming through social media, it's going to be oftentimes the most inflammatory of your work that goes viral. Right. And so somebody who is mainly reading you through that, they're not going to see all of your work chosen the way you would want to choose it in the way of an old newspaper front page. They see just what comes across their screen. And oftentimes what comes across their screen is, and I can say this as somebody who's editor-in-chief of one of these, not always the story I would have chosen to come across your screen first that day. So we, as state and local news, has really weakened as we've become nationalized in our news consumption. People listen to national political podcasts like this one. We've just developed this like intense emotional attachment to political news. It is only really about that national red-blue divide. And I do urge people, if what they're doing when they look at their news consumption is it's like 100% national and international, or 90-10 or 80-20, think about really forcing yourself to read more state and local political news. I'm not telling you not to read political news, but to just read stuff that is driving you crazy about this one national divide. At some point, there's real diminishing marginal returns on that. At some point, you already know where you stand, and you're just building up your fury more and more with people or stories that are designed to make you furious. And that is, at the very least, you should recognize what you've done at some point is gotten into a form of political entertainment. You may not enjoy it. It's not a good form of entertainment, but it is a kind of entertainment. You're not doing anything with that information. You're just getting pissed. Spend more time on state and local. Like, there's a lot of good, there's a lot of good information out there that you actually can do a lot more with. And I urge people to try to rebalance a little bit more towards where we were 10 or 15 years ago before we've had such a killing in the state and local context.
Yeah, you do offer some interesting ideas for reform here. You point to the many ways that America has actually become less democratic, from the Electoral College to the makeup of the Senate. But you also do offer solutions. You talk about bomb-proofing, democratizing, and balancing. Can you walk us through those three?
Yeah, and I'll say before I do this, and everybody gets annoyed at me for this, but I don't believe we are going to do these solutions. I'm very pessimistic about it because for all the reasons I explained, the polarization keeps us from being able to govern. It also keeps us from being able to reconstruct the way we govern to make governance easier. But nevertheless, if somebody did make me king for a day, what I'd say is that, one, a good piece of discipline on a political system is democracy, is are you building an agenda that appeals to most people? Right now, the Republican Party, because of the way it is overrepresented among rural voters, it doesn't have to do that. So it has a Senate majority that is built on a minority. It has a White House control that is built on a minority of the vote. It has a Supreme Court very much for the same reason, because it won those Senate and presidential elections. And as such, it's being able to pursue a path, one that I think is dangerous because it's beginning to move towards disenfranchisement in a lot of places through voter ID laws and, you know, Citizens United decisions and so on. It's beginning to see democracy itself as a threat to Republican Party rule, and that's very dangerous. But two, I think the Republican Party would be a healthier institution, and American politics would be a healthier politics if it had to compete for a majority of votes. And so there are a lot of ways you can imagine doing that. I mean, some are very hard to change, like the way the Senate has equal representation among states. But D.C. and Puerto Rico should be states because they should be states. It is the right and fair thing to do. These are American citizens who don't have political representation. But it would also, because those are states that are very heavily occupied, or places that are very heavily occupied by, obviously in Puerto Rico, Puerto Ricans, and in D.C., black and brown voters, it would stop sort of tilting the Senate quite as much towards one kind of voter as it does now. At the House level, you could get rid of gerrymandering, you could do proportional representation and instant runoff voting, you could just make the system a lot fairer. At the presidential level, you could get rid of the Electoral College, which at this point, the Electoral College has reversed fully 40% of the presidential election popular votes since 2000. That's not a great system. And so at some point, I very much believe we should get rid of it. Bomb-proofing is a different issue. It's about making sure that partisan gridlock can't do too much damage for no good reason. A very good example here is a debt ceiling. There's no reason we need to have a debt ceiling. Most countries don't. In most places, if the Congress or the legislature, as it may be, decides to spend, the borrowing that spending requires is automatically authorized. The fact that we have a debt ceiling here is very dangerous because the U.S. Treasury bond is the single most important financial asset in the world. A lot of other assets people have, like car loans and mortgage loans and so on, they are built on top of treasury bonds. Treasury bonds are considered a riskless asset. And so their rate of return is considered the riskless rate of return. And then the amount of risk of these other things is calculated on top of that. If treasury bonds immediately become risky, which is to say that the single asset that everybody buys when they want to make sure their money is safe, it suddenly becomes unclear if they will get paid back. That is definitionally the kind of thing that creates a financial crisis. A financial crisis is when an important financial asset that people thought they had priced correctly it instantly becomes unpriceable. And so the idea that we would do that for no reason, create a global financial crisis for no reason, is just crazy. We should just get rid of the debt ceiling. And then I talk about balancing. Balancing is trickier. It goes back to our earlier conversation about the Constitution and how it's built to balance states and places, and built to balance potentially concerns about elite versus small-d democratic rule. But it's not built to balance political parties. You could build things to balance political parties. Like, one idea you hear around, it actually came from a Vox article, but Pete Buttigieg has argued for it, is that you could construct the Supreme Court such that the Democrats had 5 seats, the Republicans had 5 seats, and then the Supreme Court justices jointly appointed another 5. And so in that case, you would lower the stakes on the Supreme Court, which have gotten very high in a very dangerous way, and make sure both parties had roughly equal representation there. And in addition, you would create a pathway to the Supreme Court that isn't simply becoming the most loyal party hack, or let me say it more gently, the most loyal party jurist that they can find. The idea that if you are a judge, a great judge who has a reputation for independence and free thinking, you now have absolutely no possibility of ever being on the Supreme Court is a little crazy. Yeah. So you can do a lot of different things like that, where you're creating spaces where the powers that the two parties will have will be equally represented, or at least that there is some guarantee of representation. In theory, the filibuster is supposed to do this in the Senate. In practice, it doesn't, because on the one hand, it is used by the minority simply to make it impossible for the majority to govern. But on the other hand, it is not used to create debate anymore. It's simply a procedural tactic. And so there is no real guarantee to debate, and we don't debate things in the Senate any longer. So there are ways that you could balance or more equally represent the parties and key institutions in a bid to try to bring down the pressure of their competition with each other and the stakes of that competition. I mean, a easier way to do the Supreme Court change, which would not balance exactly, but again, would bring down the pressure a bit. And this is something that actually Rick Perry proposed in the 2012 presidential election, is to make 12 or 18 year terms for Supreme Court justices so that you know when these seats are going to come up. Presidents are going to get an equal number of them. It's not like the lifetime appointments have quite as much weight as they do today. There's a lot you could do, but it would require a political system functional enough to do it.
Yeah, and you also have some tips in here on how folks can depolarize themselves. So I encourage everyone on the right, left, and independent to read Why We're Polarized by Ezra Klein. Ezra, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Ezra Klein for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, Why We're Polarized, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Read his regular political analysis at Vox.com, follow him on Twitter at Ezra Klein, and subscribe to The Ezra Klein Show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit KickAssNews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssNews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.